Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is February 8th, 2023. And we have three cases on our oral calendar this morning. The first is set of consolidated appeals in A22-1600, A22-1601, A22-1602, A22-1603. State of Minnesota, appellant versus Aden Mohammed Aden, respondent. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And you can choose whichever podium you prefer, the one next to you or the middle one, which, as you probably know, toggles up and down. So, counsel for appellant, if you want to set up, and then state your name and the party you represent for the record. And we're ready whenever you're ready to start.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the appellant, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. When a defendant's age determines whether district court or juvenile court has subject matter jurisdiction, the state must show by a preponderance of the evidence the defendant's age on the date of the offense. The state needs guidance from this court about what evidence is necessary to satisfy this preponderance standard. In this case, every single available government document indicated that Mr. Aden was 19 years old on the date of the alleged offenses.
Counsel, you agree that we're examining this case for clear error?
I do not.
You do not?
No, I believe the question of subject matter jurisdiction is reviewed by an appellate court de novo.
But subject matter jurisdiction is based on a factual determination regarding age, and do we not review that factual determination for clear error?
I disagree. I believe if there's a factual findings, that it should be reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard. But I believe in this case, whether or not the defendant was 18 years of old is a conclusion of law, which is what was included in the district court's order. The
How
only
is that
conclusion
a
of law.
Conclusion of law. Under Ollie, the Supreme Court case.
In this particular case, we have factual findings that were all deemed credible. The district court was very clear that they found all evidence credible, all witnesses credible. In this case, Exhibit 8 has the defendant, Mr. Aden himself, admitting that he was 19 years old. So if we also have the expert, Dr. Hoyt, opining that he is at least 2 to 3 years less than his official age, which was 19 years old during that crime spree in the fall of 2021 to the winter of 2022. So in the context of your question, Judge Larkin, I think that there's conflicting facts in the record. So one of them would have to be clearly erroneous.
There's conflicting evidence, and the district court weighed that evidence and determined that his age is not 19. So isn't that a factual finding which we review for clear error? In other words, is there evidence in the record that supports that determination regarding his age?
It is the majority of the evidence in this case, the preponderance standard. I guess the reason that I believe the district court erred here is that the preponderance standard is more probable than not. That is a legal determination applying that evidentiary threshold, which the Supreme Court is very clear in Ali, that is the standard that is taken to when determining a defendant's age in the context of whether juvenile court or district court is appropriate. And the district court erred. You can say it clearly erred or legally erred. It erred in applying that preponderance standard given the facts in this case.
Well, counsel,
your argument is simply that, well, because the government documents say he's 19, there's no other conclusion that the district court can reach?
It's because Aden himself said he was 19. He said he was 19 in 5 different court cases, 3 in juvenile court, 2 in district court. Those 2 in district court, of course, led to adult convictions. He's previously been convicted as an adult multiple times. He admitted when he voluntarily went and applied for a driver's license that he was born on July 7th, 2002, making him 19 years old on all of the relevant dates.
Are you arguing that he submitted to the court's jurisdiction by, in other cases, an adult criminal court engaging in that process and accepting a conviction?
Repeatedly he did, yes. He has accepted subject matter jurisdiction in district court multiple times, in both Hennepin County District Court and in Ramsey County District Court.
Well, that's a little bit different argument than the district court erred in accepting the doctor's testimony that he's actually younger than 19. In my mind, it seems like two different arguments. It's a factual finding regarding his age by the district court. Are you saying that factual finding's wrong, or are you saying you don't care because in the past he repeatedly has subjected himself to the jurisdiction of the district court and therefore should remain under district court jurisdiction rather than juvenile court jurisdiction?
I think it's problematic to say that the district court in this case factually found that he was a particular age because the district court clearly did not.
Sure,
the district court gave credit to Dr. Hoyt's opinion that Mr. Aiden was at least 2 to 3 years, at least, and it gave a range of 2 to 3 years less than the age that would be reflected by a birth date of July 7th, 2002. I do not believe there's any factual finding in the judge's record.
You're absolutely right. But essentially what the district court did then was say the state hasn't met its burden to establish that he was 18 at the time of this crime and therefore subject to district court jurisdiction as opposed to juvenile court jurisdiction.
Correct, and that is the single sentence conclusion of law that's included in the 9-page order and memorandum, and that is the conclusion of law that I believe the district court erred in reaching.
Well, counsel, it's also a finding of fact, is it not, to decide that he's under 18? Isn't that a factual finding?
Again, I don't believe she said that or the district court specifically found that he was under 19 years of age. I think the factual findings, as I read them, and they were a bit confusing with the qualifying terms of at least and the ranges, but it sounds like a follow-up question,
Judge. I don't think they were that confusing, and she didn't cite a number. You're right. But 2 to 3 years less than 19 would suggest that he's under 18. Right.
I agree with your math, Judge Cleary.
All right. And as she suggested in her memorandum attached to her findings, this was not a battle of the experts. The only expert that came in here went into great detail in her testimony as to bone age, growth curve, puberty, all these other reasons why the doctor felt that he was 2 to 3 years younger than July of 2007. So this is a doctor, I believe, had examined him over a period of years. So it wasn't someone just brought in to take a quick look.
Correct.
So why is the district court in error for crediting that testimony and finding that, in a finding of fact, that in fact he was 2 to 3 years younger than 19?
I guess what it comes down to, and the reason we're here today, and the reason that the state brought this appeal in these consolidated cases, is because we do need guidance about what would be necessary in this case to establish that preponderance standard, and that's what we're asking this court for. We had numerous government records that were all consistent.
But counsel, so he's adopted from another country, so he comes here, and a date of birth is assigned, and I'll just tell you, from my 13 years in Hennepin County Juvenile Court, oftentimes those dates don't mean anything. A date is assigned, and then we find out later someone is older, younger.
These things happen.
So I don't understand the argument that, well, the government documents say this is his age, therefore end of inquiry, because sometimes those documents are wrong, and they've been wrong for 16 years. It's like the better argument might be, you know, can a person submit themselves to the jurisdiction of the court such that there's no going back once you've done it.
And I believe that happened here. And in dovetailing on that question, Judge Larkin, is the fact that what the record does establish is back in 2013, I think it was July of 2013, when Dr. Hoyt began treating and began knowing Mr. Aiden, there was an indication, apparently, to her, either on her observations, or I believe she also referenced during her testimony that she was told by a guardian, not otherwise specified, of Mr. Aiden, that his official age, you know, reflected by July 7th, 2002 date of birth, was inaccurate. But it was not until 9 years later, not until after Mr. Aiden availed himself of government benefit and applied for a driver's license, not until after he subjected himself to jurisdiction in juvenile court and then jurisdiction separately in district court based on that July 7th, 2002 birth date. It was not after he told a police investigator that in January 2022 he was 19 years old, immediately after he had been arrested on the second of the four offenses as part of that escalating crime spree.
So let me ask you this. My recollection of the case law is that parties cannot agree to confer subject matter jurisdiction on a court where the court doesn't otherwise have it. And this notion of, you know, you submitted yourself to the jurisdiction of the court or you sought the jurisdiction of the court is sort of a concept that comes from criminal cases having to do with personal jurisdiction separate than subject matter jurisdiction. Do you have any legal authority for the proposition that a person can essentially confer subject matter jurisdiction on a court that doesn't otherwise have it?
I don't at the top of my head. I do not, Your Honor. I can look for that for a supplemental authority letter afterwards, but I do not have that available right now.
I think if you would have had it, we'd be seeing it.
Yeah, Counsel, I want to play off of what Judge Larkin said. My birthday happens to be New Year's Eve, 12/31, and when I was a young public defender, I used to get complaints with the date of immigrant people from different countries. And the first few, I thought, wow, everyone has my birthday. And they did. It went on and on and on. So these birthdays are assigned very sketchily. And I suppose that is not in the record, so I shouldn't take that consideration. But when I see a date like this for somebody coming from Somalia, I think, who knows where that came from?
Judge Cleary, to push back on that question, in Ali, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court decision that established the preponderance standard from 2011, Mr. Ali's birthday was January 1st, 1993. And I feel, again, looking outside the record, that date is often in cases in which individuals hail from a different country and are brought here, countries that do not have the same documentation of dates of birth, and that age may not matter as much as it matters here in the United States. But in that case, that was the date that was used in Ali for that prosecution for first-degree murder. July 7th, 2002, I agree that it could just be any age, but it's also rather specific as being, you know, it's not the end of the year. It's not the beginning of the year. It's not the beginning of a month. It's a particular date roughly halfway through the year. And we also have evidence in this case of the defendant personally, it's a recording, it can't be disputed, and the defense stipulated to its admission in the district court, Exhibit 8, of him saying he was 19 years old, which is completely consistent with that date of birth being July 7th, 2002.
Counsel, isn't it also consistent with someone who's been told his entire life that this is your date of birth, this is your age? And is that July 7th date based on evidence in the record, does it coincide with his adoption, his arrival, anything else?
He arrived in the country, I believe, in 2011, if I'm not mistaken.
What month, day?
We do not have, I would have to review Exhibit 7, and I have not done recently, Your Honor.
Let me ask
it's
you
the
this.
Immigration records.
You're saying you need guidance. In Ali, the Supreme Court rejected an argument that, well, we treat venue as jurisdictional, and the Court of Appeals has said that you have to establish venue as an element beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Supreme Court rejected that, you know, somehow saying, well, venue needs to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, but subject matter jurisdiction can be proved by a preponderance of the evidence. So the Supreme Court set the bar pretty low for the state, very low for the state. And here we had a contested hearing with an expert witness, and even though the bar was set that low, this district court judge said, I don't think the state's met its burden given what I've heard from this treating physician. I mean, you're just asking us to substitute, you're doing one of two things, asking us to substitute our view of the evidence for the district court judge's view of the evidence, which the Supreme Court has clearly told us we cannot do, or you're asking us essentially for a holding that, you know, whatever is on the legal documents controls in terms of age, which seems inconsistent with Ali, which, you know, requires something more than a legal document, because if it was just the legal document, there wouldn't be anything to talk about here, nor would there have been an Ali, probably.
I don't believe the second half is inconsistent with Ali. And what Ali did say at page 54 of that opinion is it is also significant that, although a defendant's age may rarely be open for debate, it is the defendant who has direct knowledge and control over the information necessary to resolve the dispute. Mr. Aiden didn't testify in this case. None of his family members, none of the guardians that were referenced by Dr. Hoyt testified in this case. The only evidence we have of Mr. Aiden representing his own date of birth in this case clearly establishes that he is 19 years of old in the fall of 2021 into the winter of 2022. And I did make the argument in my brief with respect to the district court's observation or finding or analysis that giving little weight to a point that Your Honor made before about just the continuation of a date in government records, or Judge Cleary's point about, you know, the date of birth just being what you've been told over and over again. But that seems directly contradicted by the pronouncement in Ali, is that the defendant is the one who has access to that information, just like Judge Cleary knows when his birthday is, as opposed to anyone else in this courtroom. And the only thing in the record from the defendant says that he's 19 years of old in the fall of 2021 into the winter of 2022, when he is fleeing from the police, when he is breaking into people's apartments, and when he is committing an armed carjacking.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
You mentioned that I knew my birthday, but I didn't grow up in Somalia, and we don't know under what conditions he was raised as a child. The other issue, of course, and he's not sophisticated in terms of criminal law, I presume, there are a number of young men who would love to add years to their age and be older than they actually are. And they might even accept when someone is given a birth date that adds 2 years to their actual age for their peer group. What was your response to that?
My first response is there's no support for that in the record. I do take your point, Judge Cleary, talking on a common sense level. I think there are reasons for both projecting a birth date that is older or younger than your actual birth date. And the only thing in the record in this case is testimony from Dr. Hoyt when she was saying why the parents or the guardians of individuals, young men or young women, if anything, would have an incentive to have the person's actual birth date be younger than what their, or be older when the, what their official age is, as opposed to what we had in this particular case.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and counsel for a respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Melvin Welch, W-E-L-C-H, on behalf of respondent. Getting started here, I just want to address a couple of items which were raised by this court in your discussions with appellant. Firstly, Your Honor, Judge Cleary, you mentioned that in your experience previously as defense attorney or public defender, you had some knowledge of age in the Somali community here in Minnesota specifically. But that was not in the record. And I think that that's an incorrect assertion. The doctor did raise it as a commonly seen observation in her experience of treating multitudes or multiple patients from Africa and Somalia in particular, that there was issues related to age. And in fact, plaintiff talked about how there was kind of an oddity in this situation where it was not an assertion of a younger age, but an assertion of an older age. So, and Judge Caligiuri, my former boss, the district court judge, did mention that that was a phenomenon that was observed. So I think the court can consider that as being in the record and support. Another issue that was raised or that was requested by the appellant is looking for guidance from this court. There has been guidance provided pretty significantly in these scenarios from this court and Supreme Court, and that's the two-step process, which is the plaintiff, or the plaintiff, the state in this case, bears the burden first by proving by preponderance of the evidence. I think that's decided a number of different cases in my standard of review, that they have the burden of proof to show by preponderance of the evidence and the defendant's rights have not been violated and they are where they are lawfully. And this is an issue of jurisdiction which can be raised at any time. If the state meets that burden, which in this case I would submit they have, they had a number of different documents. They had the defendant's own assertion, though conflicting with other assertions that are also on the record, of his age. And so that meets their burden. But then that burden comes over to the defense, in this case respondent, who must show their age is less than 18 by a preponderance of the evidence, which is exactly what was done here. I mean, ultimately, respondent brought in a very knowledgeable, and I think the district court identified the evidence that was provided as compelling and weighty regarding the age issue, and that the state had not met their burden. When the state is asking for guidance, this is a fairly simple scenario. We have an expert provided by the respondent that provides expert testimony based on their expertise, scientific observations, and their experience. And the state has the ability to have an expert look at that evidence, hear the testimony, review the evidence, and see if it comes to a different conclusion. That's not complicated. That's something that's done daily in criminal matters, especially where there is issues related to technical or scientific evidence, as there was in this case. There's no indication here that this was defense by surprise or that this was not known to the state prior, and that they had the ability to prepare for and meet their burden, which wasn't done here. It's not the court's job to do the state's job. It's not the court's job to cover down for gaps in prosecution. That is the state's obligation. It's an important obligation. It's a reinforced and reasserted obligation in every appellate case that comes, and they're meeting their burden of proof. Defense has, the only reason defense has an obligation this in any part is to meet that burden of showing their age is not 18. And it seems to me that the argument here that I'm hearing from the plaintiff is twofold. There's one where the defendant appears to assert it is the plaintiff appears to assert it is the defendant's job because he has specific knowledge regarding his age to show that he's not 18. That fails for two reasons. Number one, he has a constitutional right to not say anything. It's a Fifth Amendment right. And number two, he has no, while being there and born, he really has no specific personal knowledge of when he was born, what the circumstances were born. And as far as I know, I've not seen nor heard nor ever read in my life that there is reliable age testimony from a child from the age of birth until, I guess, I don't know what we're talking about here, 2, 3, 4, that they would have knowledge of what year they're in or otherwise. So I don't think that that's a, I don't think that that's a legitimate argument. The second one is that the plaintiff appears to be positing a law of the case, or in this case, law of the other case, as a jurisdictional waiver of the age issue in this case. And as far as I can tell, there is no precedent that supports an individual submitting to jurisdiction in a different case as accepting jurisdiction in this case. From what I remember, and I apologize because this is not something I did any type of significant review on, but from what I remember from law school first year is that jurisdiction is an issue that may be raised at any time. And I think that's even, I don't remember the statutory reference for that under our Minnesota code, but jurisdiction is an issue that the plaintiff has to establish. It is a pretrial issue that doesn't have to be proved. I believe this court identified by proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but by preponderance of the evidence. And as far as I know, and as far as I've argued before, it is something that can be raised at any time.
Counsel, can I interrupt you with a question on another issue in this case, and that is critical impact? Because this is a pretrial appeal by the state, the initial jurisdictional question that this court has to determine is whether or not we should even entertain this appeal. And I'm aware that case law says repeatedly that if a district court dismisses a case, that satisfies the critical impact standard. What I'm not aware of is whether that holding has been applied in a circumstance such as we have here, which is where although one court dismissed the case, proceedings could occur in another court, that is the district court sitting as juvenile court. So it's not really a true dismissal where the case is gone, but it's the case doesn't belong in adult district court, the case belongs in juvenile court. Do we have any case law talking about critical impact analysis in that context? I mean, because as I looked at this, I think, well, there's nothing that prevents the state from filing these charges in juvenile court. And it might have some problems in terms of what is his actual age, if they're seeking, you know, certification, presumptive or not, and the like. But is there anything that prevents the state from going forward with these charges in juvenile court?
As regards the question related to any other case law, Your Honor, this is why you're paid the big bucks, and I'm not. I'm not certain. I don't know that I would have been able to formulate the question as you have in order to do the review on it. I'm not even certain that the district court can transfer the case. I believe that because the case is in the state's hands for their discretion and prosecution, it is they that must take the initiative.
But that's what I'm asking. It's like, how can there be critical impact? Despite the fact of dismissal, is there critical impact when the state can refile the charge in the appropriate court as determined by the district court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I would submit that the basis for that is whether or not there is a significant reduction in the capability to prosecute the case. I think that's the standard. And in this case, there is not.
Let's be honest. What's different is the punishment that can be imposed and the length of probation, supervision, and whatnot.
Ostensibly.
But the evidence doesn't change, right? I mean, same charges, same evidence.
Same charges, same evidence, different venue.
Yeah, different venue. Yeah.
And ostensibly, it could very well be the same penalty. Firstly, penalty, as far as I can tell from my review, is not an element of consideration in determining whether there has been a significant reduction in the likelihood of successful prosecution.
Then those are the cases I'm asking about. I'm not aware of anything. The cases I've read all go to, can the state prove this case given the district court's pretrial order?
Oh, the state can most assuredly pursue this case. And I the state does make an assertion that there is an effectual block to pursuing this case in juvenile jurisdiction court. Now, I want to address that in two manners. Firstly, the court was not asked to make that decision. What is his age?
Right.
The court was asked to make the decision, is he 18? Two different questions. To decide the other question, I guess, would be the judge, personally or assuredly within the court's discretion and ability, if it so desired to do, although that probably would be going beyond the issue it was asked to answer. But in this case, the court does identify likely 16 or 17 years at the age. All right, firstly, court doesn't have to make that decision. That's the state's burden to prove what the age is. Let's say he wasn't 16 or 17. Let's say it was 15 or 16. The court or the appellant makes the issue, okay, if he's 16, we have a presumptive certification. If he's 15, we don't have a presumptive certification. We have to go through the process of having him certified.
But did your expert say anything that would support a conclusion that he's 15? I thought it was 2 to 3 years younger than 19. So that would put him at 16 or 17.
Correct.
Which would get us into presumptive EJJ, presumptive cert, EJJ designation. I mean, I don't see this as a case where we're on, you know, arguing between 15 and 16, which would make a significant difference in terms of what the district court could do with him if he were found guilty. It seems that we are, and I mean, if it's EJJ or cert, it's a jury trial, presumptive sentence stayed. I'm having a hard time understanding why there's critical impact here.
And that's where I did make the argument that there's not, and that was my primary argument, that there's not a critical impact here. Firstly, you have to show that there's the significant reduction likely success of prosecution, which has not been shown. All avenues to prosecute remain open. The potential consequence is not a consideration in that determination. And secondly, I guess the other argument I made was you have to show that the district court clearly erred. Yes, the legal conclusion is reviewed de novo, but the factual determinations are reviewed for clear error. And in this case, Judge Caligiuri did a very thorough review after a very thorough evidentiary hearing regarding what the facts were and what the conclusions were therefrom.
Counsel, just to follow up Judge Larkin's question, the district court found that a preponderance of the evidence supported the conclusion the defendant was at least 2 years younger. Doesn't suggest a specific age. So would that not possibly open up the issue in juvenile court that the young man would not qualify for EJJ or certification, then he was even younger.
Sure, it would, but it does not stop or it does not stop the capability of the prosecution to pursue, or sorry, the appellant to pursue prosecution, even if he's, let's say he is younger, and that's why I was using a worst case scenario.
As a juvenile, rather than trying.
If he's 15, yeah. 14, okay. 13, you can still, well, maybe not 13, I'd have to review my knowledge of law there, but in that particular age frame, it just requires a certification process. Having to go through the certification process is not a significant reduction in the likelihood of a successful prosecution. It's just you have the capability, you have the job, you have the duty. Do your job, do your duty. And that's what we ask, that's what we request of the state, and that's what we expect of the state. That's where the state draws its legitimacy and its trust is in meeting these burdens and pursuing its duty to the extent it does in order to support the legitimacy as an institution. It ought not look for shortcuts in its ability to prosecute individuals. It ought to embrace the chance that it has the opportunity to show the legitimacy in fulfilling its functions. Sorry, I got off track there and a little
no,
bit.
No, I understand. Soapbox. I understand your point, but in terms of critical impact, arguably we're kicking the can over to juvenile court now, and they're going to have to decide the age. Same issue.
Correct. But at a bare minimum, we know the age is not 18. That factual finding has been made. That has become the law of this case here. What the actual age is a burden that remains the state's to prove. I don't have anything else
to... May I just follow up on
yes,
that? Are you suggesting that the determination in this case then will have a preclusive effect on age in the juvenile court? So if it's determined to be 18 here, it's law of the case in the next case?
It would be disingenuous, I feel, Your Honor, for me to assert that the defense could take a position in adult court and then reverse its position in juvenile court. It would be illogical. It would be difficult to take that position. I certainly don't want to handcuff the public defender, whoever is representing Mr. Aiden, at that position. And they certainly, I suppose, could take that position. It would lower the legitimacy and the credibility of their argument significantly to do so, especially after we've been here spending the time and resources to argue this out. I have 50 seconds left, but I really am concluded with my statements. And if the court has no other arguments, I will thankfully rest.
Thank you. And rebuttal.
Counsel, perhaps you could address critical impact first.
Yes, building on your question, Judge Cleary. Dr. Hoyt testified at pages 24, 28, and 35 of the transcript that she opined, she believed that Mr. Aiden was anywhere between 2 to 4 years younger than the official age of that date of birth of July 7th, 2002, which 4 years younger than 19 puts you in 15, and the problem...
Nonetheless... Is there case law that says when assessing critical impact, you can consider the potential reduction in punishment that would come from a contrary decision?
Judge Larkin, I looked. I could not find any.
My understanding is successful prosecution, can you prove the case or not? How does your ability to prove the case change if you go from prosecution in adult court to prosecution in juvenile court?
On a very practical level, we probably couldn't file the petition because, as you're aware from your experience in district court, you need a date of birth in which to literally get district court administration to accept a juvenile delinquency petition. And we're not sure what date we should include because the only available documented date of birth for this individual has just been found to be wrong if this court were to affirm the district court. So at a very basic level...
Step back. You're saying you can't file a complaint if you don't know the defendant's date of birth?
Walking back to your experience being an advocate in district court, when we're filing documents from the state, we need to have certain information or other district court rejects it for filing, much like if we comply with certain requirements, the clerk of appellate courts rejects our filings.
But you're telling me that if you attempted to file this case in juvenile court under these circumstances where the actual age is unknown, but the district court has made a finding that he is less than 18, you will not be allowed to file that petition in juvenile court?
I believe the juvenile court, the juvenile delinquency petition will require a date of birth in order to be accepted by the district court administration.
Well, I understand maybe district court administration says that. Can you cite me in any statute or case law that says you can't file it? And I mean, it seems a pretty tenuous argument that you have an order from a district court judge saying, I found he's not 18.
I
get that you don't know the date, but I fail to see how with that order under these circumstances, Hennepin County Juvenile Court would not allow this case to be filed there.
I totally understand where you're coming from, Judge Larkin. I want to go back to the way I started, which is just looking for guidance. And I understand that Judge Caligiuri, to agree with Mr. Welch, was not given any alternative date in which to select and factually find this was Mr. Aiden's date of birth. There's a footnote, I think footnote 2 in her order.
You're looking for guidance on the issue of the how do you prove or how does, you've established by preponderance that he's over 18. He rebutted that. The court accepted that. That's the issue before us. We're not going to give you guidance on how you file a new case, what you put in the petition, or how you make it successful. Our question is there critical impact in the sense that, the only sense that's discussed in case law, this pretrial decision prevents you from proving your case, from having a successful prosecution, in terms of is he guilty or not?
On that question, I believe a strict application of Serbis and Underhall says dismissal of a complaint, and that's exactly what happened
and
here.
And that's why I raised the issue. In all those cases, we're dismissing a district court case.
Which age was not a question, and the possibility of pursuing
question.
A petition in juvenile court was off the table.
Yeah, Word. So that's an issue of first impression. What do you say to that? How do we apply those cases to these facts when they don't seem to fit? There's nothing that prevents you, might say procedural issues, but until you try and it's rejected and then you come back up here complaining that no one let you file, I mean, in theory, you've got an order from a district court judge saying he's under 18. Why can't you pursue your prosecution in juvenile court?
Here's something for this panel to consider. A remand, and I'm not necessarily saying that any of the factual findings, if this court, as I'm sensing from this morning, is in agreement with Judge Caligiuri on, but a remand for the purpose of guidance on, for two of the four offenses, the difference between age 15 and 16 matters, whether or not it's a presumptive certified or not, if we were to go in a juvenile court, and that's the second and the fourth.
So a remand to tell Judge Caligiuri to determine his age?
Not to say determine his age, but maybe.
I'm sure she'd love to be told by the Court of Appeals that she needs to determine his age when the law does not require her to do that.
The problem is, so there's footnote 2 of her order. She points out that she observed when she watched the Exhibit 8, the body-worn camera footage. Judge Smith, I see my time has expired. May I finish my answer?
Please.
Thank you. That there was a date of birth that was provided by Mr. Aiden as being October 30th, 2004, which would actually place him, clearly, squarely in juvenile court. Please watch and listen to Exhibit 8. There's no reference to October 30th, 2004 in that recording. I'm not sure where that factual finding in that footnote, her factual observation, came from. But practically speaking, if we're going to go back to juvenile court and file those delinquency petitions, and I completely agree with you, Judge Larkin, that the elements of each of the offenses, from the ones that happened in September, the one that happened in January, the two that happened in February, those don't change. The evidence is still available to present in a juvenile court setting as opposed to a district court forum. The problem becomes when other aspects of juvenile procedure, certification, presumptive certification, the public safety factors in 260B 130, do those apply? Do those not apply? Do we just have to pick July 8th, 2004 as a tentative date of birth to include and try to litigate? I agree, going back to Judge Smith's question before.
It seems to me you've got to litigate all that.
Right,
and we can't give you instructions for what to do to get this case to juvenile court. All we're asked to decide is, did the district court err in determining he's under 18?
And then
before we even get to that, the first question is, does that decision have a critical impact on the state's case in the sense that the state cannot successfully prosecute its case as a result of that decision? And the case law that we have, you know, although it says, well, a dismissal is critical impact, doesn't present the circumstances here, which is it's a dismissal in one court. It doesn't mean that the other court's not available to you.
I will agree, Judge Larkin, that the question does not have a clear answer in existing case law, particularly controlling case law. And I realize I'm far beyond the time.
So maybe that's where you need guidance.
I believe I included...
Because that's the first question.
I believe I included a footnote in either my principal brief or my prior brief encouraging this court to consider issuing a precedential decision on that very question. But the state's position at base is that the district court erred in applying the preponderance standard to the evidence that was presented to her in this proceeding. I am happy to entertain any other questions.
Looks like we are done with our questions. Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Thank you.
Thank you.